Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important and largest segment of society. To those of you who know that the world's religious, political, economic, academic, military, and media institutions are corrupt, and that all of these institutions are counterproductive and cannot be fixed. Our phone number, if you would like to participate in this discussion anytime over the next 2 hours, is toll-free 877-300-7645. I am Yada. The president was listening to a child saying what's called the Lord's Prayer and then said it is a tradition that unifies us. I would beg to disagree. First of all, there is no Lord's Prayer. The exemplar prayer that exists in the Christian New Testament is highly edited. First of all, he is not the Lord. If you're dealing with Yahusha, the Christians have a caricature of him that they misname Jesus Christ. He would tell you, and he has told us emphatically, that the Lord is Satan. It is only Satan that wants to control. It is only Satan that wants people to submit to him. He is called the Lord throughout the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. The Hebrew word is Baal, or Lord, because it fits his nature. It fits his identity. What does Satan want? He wants to be worshipped as if he were a god. And the human constructions of God, the false gods, all want to be worshipped. They all want people to be in fear of them. They want to have people be afraid that if they don't surrender, they don't submit, that they will have their britches toasted in a flaming hell. All of that is paganism. All of that is false religion. So when you talk about the Lord's Prayer, you're talking about Satan. Now, it's interesting that throughout the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, which is the totality of Yahweh's testimony, there is some commentary on that provided by Yosha that's recorded in Matanyah and Yahochanan and the revelation to Yahochanan that also has merit. But throughout Yahweh's comprehensive presentation of who he is, what he wants, what he expects from us, what he's offering, he never once asks us to pray. Never once. It's one of the reasons why Paul's line, pray without ceasing, is so utterly in conflict with what God has asked for. God, in fact, Yosha says, you know, what are you bothering to tell God what you want? First of all, he's already given you the most valuable thing you could possibly have, which is the covenant and the benefits of being adopted into his family. He says, you know, he knows what his children need. If you're part of his covenant, he knows exactly what you need. You don't need to ask him. I don't ask him. Why would you do that? You know, demean him? You think he's stupid? Beyond that, he says that the prayers of those who do not observe the Torah are an abomination to him. He does not hear them. He does not listen to them. And so 100% of Christians are adverse to the Torah if they were in tune with the Torah, if they observed the Torah, if they cared about the Torah, they wouldn't be Christians. So it's this blanket statement. 100% of Christians are in opposition to, or at the very least without the Torah. And according to Yahweh's testimony, the prayer of someone who is not observing the Torah is an abomination to him. So if you're engaged in a prayer breakfast, if you're praying to God, unless you are a member of the covenant, you're wasting your time. In fact, it's far worse than you wasting your time when Yahweh says that the prayers of those who do not observe the Torah are an abomination to him. You're irritating God. So it's far worse than not doing it at all. And if you're having a Lord's Prayer, then the God that you're praying to is Satan. And you ought not do that either. That's extraordinarily counterproductive. So, folks, we need to think these things through, and we need to realize why it is that Yosha said, don't ever pray in public. Hypocrites pray in public. Look at all of the of these kinds of events. What did the Obamanator do? It was part of a public prayer, the National Day of Prayer, the public prayer. What did Yosha say don't do? Don't pray in public. You know, it's amazing to me that Christians think that their religion was founded by this mythical individual named Jesus Christ, and that they are followers of Jesus Christ, and that Jesus Christ is the inspiration of their New Testament, and that Jesus Christ is the founder of their church, when none of that is even remotely true. They don't even listen to him. I mean, think of that. He said, don't pray in public. What are they doing? They get in their churches, and they all pray in public. He said, don't think for a moment that I came to annul the Torah. What do they do in their churches? They spit on the Torah. And it's a complete and utter joke that people aren't smart enough to figure out that the religion of Christianity is just based on an absolute pile of impossible lies. It has no basis in truth. Lord's Prayer is a great example of it. Now, even the content of this exemplar prayer, if you will, if it occurred at all, is such that we would be wise to recognize that it has been, at the very least, highly edited. It may be entirely made up, but at the very least, it's highly edited. It was one of those grand examples in the Textus Receptus. The Textus Receptus did not have that glorious ending to the Lord's Prayer that you see now in 100% of your English Bibles. And the guys that were foisting it as an economic fraud, the Textus Receptus said, well, you know, it wasn't in the manuscript. They had a 12th century manuscript that they were copying. It wasn't even a very good manuscript, but that's what they were copying. It wasn't in there. And on the but they wanted the endorsement also of the Roman Catholic Church, since they were dominant. And the Roman Catholic Church says, you know, we like this ending, as you know, power and glory and all that kind of stuff. We just love that stuff. And you saw it in your text. And they said, well, it was in the manuscript. They said, well, what would it, you know, what would it take to get you to add it? They said, well, I guess we'd have to see it in the manuscript. And so the Roman Catholic Church says, all right, I the spokesperson, the negotiator said, I got an idea here for you. It's in our Latin Vulgate. If I translate the Latin Vulgate back into Greek, then it's in a Greek manuscript that you could add it. And they did. That's how these things are done. That's how religions manipulate. And then it became part of the what's called the Textus Receptus, which was an absolute, utter joke. And from the Textus Receptus, it became part of virtually every English Bible translation, even though it was never said. Now, beyond this idea, it brings us together. America is supposed to be a nation without a religious preference, without the imposition of a religion. This so-called Lord's Prayer is strictly Christian, which means that it's not going to bring together a Jew or a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Hindu or a atheist or an agnostic. There's no bringing together here. There is a dividing along religious lines. That's something to think about, isn't it? And why would he say that it brings us together when, in fact, it is a specific religion? Now, the fact is, America does have a national religion. It's political correctness. And it's imposed in academia, the media, and in politics. It's imposed even today in business and in the military. It's universal political correctness. It's grotesquely amoral and, in many cases, immoral. But you listen to things like this and it just drives you crazy. I do give me just a couple of things off the top. The beginning of this exemplar, and by the way, it's interesting here, that don't think for a moment that Yosha, even if you knew his name, was telling his disciples that they should pray to him in that manner. He wasn't. He wasn't encouraging them to pray. He had never mentioned prayer. He had been with them 3 years, and they had never seen him pray. They had never heard him pray. They had never even heard him mention anything associated with prayer after 3 years. Now, that tells you a lot, folks. He had met with thousands of people. He had communicated information, answered questions, dealt with people of all walks of life for 3 years, and they recorded what he had to say. And over those 3 years, he never once engaged in prayer, never once spoke of prayer, never once encouraged anyone to pray. So anyway, he's about ready to fulfill the first three Moed Mikre. And in that context, they say, well, you know, this is probably something we ought to know. We religious people pray, and I know we have never talked about religion. In fact, you've been anti-religious, but, you know, we're going to be asked about this. This is certainly one of the questions that we're going to be asked, because, you know, people want to be conditioned to know how to pray. That's one of the biggest things, for example, the Islamic State. They have instructions on how to pray, and they communicate those instructions on how to pray as a Muslim. And if you don't pray the way they want you to pray, of course, there's severe consequence. You know, the Roman Catholic Church is so into praying that they have kneeling cushions in all of their pews. You know, if you walk into a Roman Catholic Church, you'll see women kneeling down and praying to statues of Mary. You know, it's just pathetic. But what he said is interesting, if indeed any of this is true. But it begins, Our Father. So this notion that Christians pray to him, stupid. The one time he's going to talk about this subject, he says, nope, not praying to me. It's Our Father. Our Heavenly Father, our Father who is in heaven. Set apart is your name. Well, how in the hell are you going to address him if you don't know what his name is? If his name is set apart, if it's unique, if it's important, why don't you know it? Why don't you use it? Not a Christian in the world follows what Yosha had to say. A video showing the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria militants burning a captive Jordanian pilot to death brought an outpouring of grief and rage across the Middle East on Wednesday because of its brutally horrifying depiction, even in a region that is accustomed to horrifying violence. Political and religious leaders were collectively offered angry denunciations and called for blood, while at least one on air while talking about the killing of the 26-year-old Lieutenant Mu'ah al-Kasbah, whose F-16 crashed in Syria in December during a U.S.-led coalition raid on the extremist group. They universally miss the point. It's as if they ought to have taken a deep breath and realize cause and consequence. You know, I always am attuned to trying to figure out who struck first, because who struck first is always important. A person has a right to defend themselves. A person, almost all people, will retaliate. You know, you look at World War II and Pearl Harbor. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, killed about 3,000 American troops and took out the sailors and took out some of our Pacific Fleet ships. It was a military attack against a military. And America had an absolute conniption fit, you know, called it vile and everything else. And you know, it was a military attack against the military. We were a sleeping target, and they attacked a military target. They didn't attack civilians. They didn't firebomb Honolulu. They didn't target any civilians or any civilian facility. And yet America responded in righteous indignation and firebombed virtually every Japanese city, including Tokyo. And we specifically targeted women, children, and the elderly. We specifically targeted to burn to death, to burn alive civilians, just as we did in Germany. And if you look just in this particular situation with the Islamic State, the Islamic State grew out of Ibrahim Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's religious response to the American invasion of Iraq. It was before America invaded Iraq, al-Baghdadi was just an Islamic cleric. And after we invaded Iraq, after we used cluster bombs on Iraq, after we had previously, on the previous Iraqi war, used shock and awe to bomb Iraqi cities, to bomb Iraq back 100 years into its history. After we had done that, after we had killed so many Iraqis, burned them to death, buried them alive in their buildings and in their homes, and then we invaded Iraq on a pile of lies, just on a pile of lies, none of it justifiable. And we invade Iraq, that caused al-Baghdadi, who is now the leader of the Islamic State, to respond in kind. We not only hit, we were savage. We not only hit, we were violent. We not only struck, what we did was brutally horrifying. The best estimates are between 300,000 and 1 million Iraqi civilians lost their lives as a result of the American invasion of that country. We struck first. So why are we so horrified when the Islamic State responds and burns a belligerent? They didn't burn a civilian. They didn't take a little girl and burn her alive at the stake. They didn't go into a city and bomb the entire city into dust and rubble, killing everyone inside. They didn't do what we do. They killed somebody that was engaged killing them. This pilot wasn't out there taking flight lessons. He wasn't flying a Cessna Caravan. He was flying an F-16 for the express purpose of dropping bombs on members of the Islamic State and their families. And he crashed in the process. And they gave him some of his own. We ought to look at cause and consequence. I want to be absolutely clear. What the Islamic State has done and is doing is not justifiable. It's not civil. Not appropriate. It's disgusting. And it's Islamic. They are acting just like Muhammad. Muhammad was among a handful of the most despicable men who ever lived. You know, along with Muhammad, you'd have Paul, founder of the Christian religion. You'd have Akiba, the founder of Judaism. You'd have the likes of Constantine and Theodosius, the contributors to the political nature of Roman Catholicism. You'd have Hadrian, who was the mass killer of Jews. And you could throw in some modern morons, like certainly an Adolf Hitler or a Tamerlane, to be among the most repulsive people in history. But Muhammad was clearly among the worst five individuals who ever lived. And no matter how you want to consider his life, whether it's be the fact that he was a ruthless terrorist, the fact that he was a mass murderer, the fact that he was a thief, the fact that he was a rapist, the fact that he was incestuous, the fact that he was a pedophile, the fact that he was a sexist, the fact that he was an avowed liar, the fact that he created a religion and a god for the sole purpose of satiating his own lust for sex, power, and money. I mean, you name it. If you just want to look at the stupidity and the grotesque immorality of his Quran and Hadith, his words and deeds, his imposition of Sharia law based upon his grotesque and perverted life. No matter how you look at it, Muhammad was among and could well qualify as the single most perverted and despicable person who ever lived. And that's not my opinion. Read the Quran and Hadith. It's the only conclusion that can be drawn from the evidence that is made available to us. And the Islamic State is acting just like Muhammad. Everything they do is just like Muhammad. Since Muhammad was the lone exemplar of what it means to be a Muslim, since he is the basis of Islam, since he is the lone spokesperson, the lone messenger, he is the et-all and end-all of Islam, the Islamic State jihadists are perfect Muslims. And as perfect Muslims, they are reprehensible people. And what they did was reprehensible. But it's the point that needs to be made, that the world needs to open its eyes, is that not only is Islam horrifyingly brutal and grotesquely immoral, but so is the rest of the world. That pilot was flying a warplane for the purpose of bombing civilian targets, causing people to be confined, to be buried alive, in many cases burned alive. The United States had caused this through its invasion of Iraq on a pile of lies. No Iraqi had anything to do with 9/11. No Iraqi had killed an American. No Iraqi had threatened an American. And even if Iraqi had, and they hadn't, wouldn't be justification to invade their country. They didn't have chemical and biological weapons beyond those we had given to them. The United States gave it to them. They didn't have stockpiles sitting around ready to deploy of chemical and biological weapons. They weren't making a nuclear bomb. We had no justification for the first invasion, much less the second. We broke that country. We buried people alive. We burned them alive. And we burned people who had done nothing to us. We burned civilians and buried civilians alive, mutilating their bodies. And we did it by the hundreds of thousands. And the Jordanians want to cry in their beer. The Americans want to wallow in their perceived morality and condemn this act when they're not willing to look themselves in the mirror? This is grotesque, folks. You may want to blame the Japanese, for example, for America engaging in World War II, and it was, you know, we had to strike back. Well, there were lots of ways to respond. The way we respond led to the deaths of over a million Japanese, almost all of whom were civilians, well, the preponderance of which were civilians. We sacrificed, you know, 300,000 men to avenge the deaths of 3,000. How is that moral? How is that victory? And even here in this context, you've got Muslim leaders wallowing all over themselves. And it's just stupid. Let's continue a little more through this article, because it reveals so much of the absolute dumbing down of the world's capacity to think. The head of Sunni Islam's most respected seat of learning, and they really don't have a respected seat of learning. It is their, at one time, Al-Ahar University, it's Al-Dha, and then A-Z-H-A-R University, it's in Cairo, was the, as the birthplace of the Muslim Brotherhood, as the most acclaimed university in the Islamic world, and it's a horrible place. Just tells you how despicable Islamic universities are, and how in the world of Islam only a religious school is has any credentials. And the fact that, as I say, this university was the birthplace of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's the, not only the birthplace, it remains the capital of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood is the wellspring from which all fundamentalist Islamic terrorist groups today of Sunni persuasion have sprung. To whatever degree Al-Qaeda existed and exists, it's a derivative of the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, Azam was a professor educated at Al-Zahar, who was an Israeli Arab Muslim who was the original founder of the organization. But you look at the PLO, you look at the Taliban, almost every one of these Islamic terrorist organizations had their inspiration, had their initial founder come from the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Azhar University. And then they go as far as to say here, and this is just utter duplicity, they said that the militants deserve the Quranic punishment of death, crucifixion, or chopping off of their arms and legs for being enemies of Allah and the Prophet Muhammad. Now, let's think about it. They deserve the Quranic punishment of death, crucifixion, or chopping off of their arms and legs for being enemies of Allah and the Prophet Muhammad. What they're doing here, folks, is citing Quran 5:33. It's the most vicious statement ever attributed to a god. It is, since crucifixion is vastly, vastly, overwhelmingly, unbelievably, undeniably more agonizing, more brutal, more horrifying way to die than would be burning alive, which, by the way, was the Christian favorite, burning people at the stake. That here you've got a verse in the Quran where Allah is telling Muslims to go crucify people, to cut off arms and legs on opposite sides, to kill them slowly, painfully, agonizingly. And you can't make a connection. You're a journalist. You're writing this story down, and you think, oh, wow, you've got a the seat of most respected seat of learning. For Sunni Islam is saying that the Islamic State jihadists ought to die for what they did, and that shows you that Islam is a loving and caring religion, when this moron just quoted Quran 5:33, which orders Muslims to inflict a vastly more agonizing and brutal way of death, crucifixion. Mutilation and crucifixion. Now, what's interesting, of course, here, is that form of death is for those who are in opposition to Islam, those who don't surrender to Islam, and the jihadists are perfect Muslims. They would be the ones perpetrating that form of death. You know, when I wrote Tea with Terrorists, which was immediately after meeting with Al-Qaeda in 2001, in the fall of 2001, I wanted a plot device, because that's written in the form of a novel, to focus the readers on a plausible act that would cause somebody who is a right-wing Christian patriot military guy to shed all of that and to be jolted into a realization that, my God, I need to understand this religion of Islam. And so I had a crucifixion scene play out in that book, written at a time that a crucifixion hadn't occurred in, you know, in a very, very, very long time. And come to find out now, the Islamic State is using crucifixion. And, of course, crucifixion is specifically dictated by Allah. The fifth surah of the Quran is the last revealed. There's no way to abrogate it. And by the time we get to the fifth surah, Allah's enemies are principally Christians because he's overhunted Jews. And Muslims are told to crucify them. That's what their God, if you want to believe Allah's a God, orders them to do. That was the turning point in Tea with Terrorists. And here now you have an Islamic cleric says, nah, you know what we ought to do, because this was so savage, burning a man alive, we ought to respond through crucifixion. Oh, it's a lovely religion. Quote from the Grand Sheikh, of course he's a religious title, of Al-Jahar University, Ahmed Al-Taib. Quote, Islam prohibits the taking of an innocent life. No, it doesn't. Never has. And by the way, what they do is, in terms of innocent, they define innocent as someone who has wholly and completely surrendered, which is what Islam means, to Islam and to their specific interpretation of Islam. And so the Quran, it says, if a Muslim rejects Islam, kill him. Now, why would rejecting Islam make a person anything other than innocent? But if Muslim rejects Islam, the Quran says kill him. It doesn't say kill him if they're a soldier and an enemy combatant. It doesn't say kill him if they have killed those you love. It doesn't say kill them if they're bombing you. It says if they reject the religion, kill them. The Quran tells us in the 8th surah, which was the first depiction of Muhammad's piracy, that Muslims are supposed to kill anyone who opposes Islam. And it even says in there that Muhammad couldn't take captives, he couldn't enslave people until he'd made a great slaughter in the land. Those he killed were all civilians, they were all innocent. And the Quran was not only acknowledging that Muhammad killed these innocent civilians, the traitors. Trade as in commerce, not traitors in terms of those who are working against a country. But it wallows in it, it glorifies it. Muhammad had his goons, the first Muslims, murder in their sleep, plunging knives into their hearts while their children slept beside them in bed. Three women poets who told the truth about him. When Muhammad decided that he needed some bloodlust for his Muslims, a little entertainment, he murdered 900 men and little boys in the course of one afternoon, cutting off their heads. Now, you tell me how that's not taking an innocent life. Islam prohibits taking innocent life. Hogwash, pal. In the first 100 years of Islam's existence after Muhammad's death, Muslims killed over 250 million innocent people. How can this idiot write this drivel? as a correspondent, as a alleged journalist. This moron, Grand Sheikh, added that by burning the pilot to death, the militants violated Islam's prohibition on the mutilations of bodies even during wartime. Good God! I mean, it's as if to be a Muslim and to be a high-ranking Muslim, everything you say has to be a lie. The same battle of Badr, and not even a battle, it was a terrorist raid. It was an act of piracy. When Muhammad had his armed goons attack the Meccan caravan for the express purpose of robbing it, the hadith accounts of Muhammad's behavior, and Muhammad's behavior is the basis of Islamic law. So what is and isn't acceptable in Islam is based solely on what Muhammad said and did. So if Muhammad prohibited mutilation of bodies, then it would be prohibited in Islam. If Muhammad mutilated bodies, then it would be condoned in Islam, acceptable in Islam. That's the bottom line. So what does the Quran and Hadith say? Speaking of this terrorist raid, of this robbery of the Meccan caravan, where it is denoted in the Quran that Muhammad had to make a great slaughter before he could enslave people. The hadith of that event goes on and on about how Muhammad personally mutilated the bodies of those he killed, and after mutilating them, gloated over them. What do people have against the truth?